This is a Studio 809 podcast. Engage.
Welcome to Peak Environment, the Pikes Peak Region's podcast about environmental stewardship. This episode features the Sustainability in Progress monthly speaker program. It happens the third Wednesday of every month and is presented by the Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future. For more information, visit peakalliance.org.
Welcome to Sustainability in Progress, or SIP for short, for May 2025. I'm Mary Barber, a board co-chair of Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future. Welcome. We are so happy you could join us today to learn more and join the conversation about affordable housing. I don't want to take too much time from our presenter today, but I'd like to say a little bit about Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future, also sometimes referred to as PASF or Peak Alliance. Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that strives to promote regional sustainability in the Pikes Peak region and to advance the regional sustainability plan called Looking to Our Future, Pikes Peak Region 2030. The process of creating the plan involved over 150 individuals and organizations, and it was supported by the Department of Defense Office of Economic Adjustment, Fort Carson, and Pikes Peak Area Council of Governments, among others. The document, PPR 2030, is how we refer to it occasionally, was finalized in 2012. Not wanting the document to just be a document collecting dust on a shelf, the community involved in creating it wanted a champion, and thus PASF was established. The plan features stretch goals for 10 issue areas: agriculture, arts and culture, built and natural environment, economic development, education, energy, health, materials management and procurement, transportation, and water quantity. You can download a copy of the plan on our website, peakalliance.co.org. Outreach and education are a major focus of our work, and so we conduct this monthly event, Sustainability in Progress, or SIP for short, to help spread the word. It occurs on the third Wednesday of the month, generally from 12 to 1 via Zoom. I'd like to give a shout out to Dave Gardner. He's an author, producer, content creator, podcaster, and he supports our opportunity here today with the SIP. We're recording this event for an episode of the Peak Environment podcast. You can find Peak Environment on your favorite podcast app, including Spotify, or at studio809podcast.com. Or you can listen to it on the Peak Alliance website, again at peakalliance.co.org. I want to acknowledge that the land we are on is within the unceded territory of the Ute peoples. The earliest documented peoples include Apache, Arapaho, Comanche, and Cheyenne. I encourage you to learn more about the legacy of these tribes and the traditional ecological knowledge that can inform our lives and jobs. I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Ms. Jill Gabler, Executive Director of the Pikes Peak Housing Network. Ms. Gabler currently serves as the inaugural Executive Director at Pikes Peak Housing Network, a local nonprofit advocating for housing affordability, access, and production. She's a former city councilwoman for District 5 in Colorado Springs and a constant advocate for our thriving community. During her 8 years on City Council, Jill focused her work on multimodal transportation, attainable housing, downtown development, and local food production. So, Jill, I gave a pretty short introduction about you. What else would you like us to know?
Well, welcome everyone, and thank you so much for having me here today. As I was listening to you talk, Mary, I was reminded of the times in our past where we have work together, and I do believe we've worked together on the Fountain Creek watershed. I believe we did some touring down in the southern portion and food production issues. So it's nice to be working with you again in online here.
Me too,
as technology changes and we move into the future.
Yeah.
Thank you for that introduction. As you mentioned, I am the inaugural executive director of Pikes Peak Housing Network, and this organization was started by a group of community members who were really trying to figure out what we should be doing about our housing crisis. And a lot of them are people you probably know, BJ Scott and Lee Patke and David Lord. And they put together a group called the Affordable Housing Collaborative. And out of that, they had a lot of community meetings and met with community leaders. And they decided that it was important to have an organization that was focusing 24/7 on housing affordability issues. So they started the Pikes Peak Housing Network. I have been in this role since November of 2023, so it's been about 18 months. And the founders, instead of starting on yet another nonprofit, they chose to at least initially house us within the Chamber and EDC here in Colorado Springs. So we are a hosted organization, which is really helpful for me because I am a one-person band, and they, of course, handle all my financial stuff and my pay and everything that I don't want to spend my time doing, so I can really focus on the work. So in the 18 months that I've been here, we created our first strategic plan, which was really important because there are just so many things we could be focusing our time on. But that plan is really guiding my work as the sole individual who works at Pikes Peak Housing Network. And we are really focused on trying to change the hearts and minds of our community members on the support of housing, all types of housing, but especially affordable housing in our community. And we're doing that by collecting a lot of data around the need for housing, who lives in affordable housing. There's a lot of misunderstanding about who qualifies for affordable housing, like our military service members, our nurses, our teachers. And so those are the folks we're trying to provide homes for in our community, and just the data around how expensive housing has gotten and who can afford the housing that we're building, what types of housing we're building so that we can move our developers to be building more of the types of housing that we need. And most importantly, I spend a lot of time and collect a lot of data for our decision makers, our city's planning commission, our county commissioners, and our council members, so that they understand the importance of housing and that they will hopefully vote to support the projects that come before them.
I see that you all have recently completed a report that was chock full of all data. That's on your website.
Yes, thank you.
And I was wondering what you might want to bring out as far as that is, data and conclusions that you drew in the report.
We did complete our inaugural State of Housing Report, and that was released in February of this year, and we had an event to release it. And a lot of people came to an event that talked about housing data. I was a little surprised at all the eggheads who care about these issues, but it was a great event. And one of our goals is to bring all of the folks who are working in the housing sector together, the financiers, the landowners, the developers, so that they can find each other and do good projects. So that event was a big success there. The report has a lot of great data in it, and my goal was to make it really user-friendly so that it becomes a tool for all of us to use as we're just having those anecdotal conversations around the need for housing in our community. I think there are a couple really great things that came out of that report that are going to be difficult for me to describe, but I will try. So one of the biggest pieces, I have a funnel graph, and the first funnel shows based on the incomes of the individuals in our region. And of course, we have all that data from the census in the county. We can see what types of and prices of homes that those people can afford. And the majority of our community members can afford a home between $300,000 and $500,000. But really, it's more of that lower end. And then the second funnel is a picture of what our developers are building. And 34% of the homes that are being built in El Paso County are more than $700,000. And so the funnel really very quickly, pictorially, explains part of the issue of who our community is and what kind of housing they can afford compared to what we're building. And there is a complete mismatch there. And so that it's really important for our developers to see that and to understand that the type of housing we should be building is smaller starter homes, condos, duplexes, all of those missing middle types of housing that align with, I think, what the SIP and what sustainable individuals, people who are in that community care about, of really trying to create healthy communities that we used to build. And now we have stopped building communities that are holistic, walkable, bikeable, and just easy for our community members to navigate on foot or bike to accomplish the services and the needs they have every day. David has a question.
If you want people to be able to see the funnels, mm-hmm. we can post those to the Studio 809 website and mm-hmm. put a link in the show notes.
Yes, and you mentioned the State of Housing Report is on my website, and it's easily downloaded or viewed there, so I can give you that link too. pphousingnetwork.org. It's right on the homepage. It's the first thing you see is a link to our State of Housing Report. And we will complete that report every year for this community. I think it will change based on, you know, what we're hearing and what the needs of the community are. I'm starting to spend more time focusing on stories of our community members. Because again, as I hear people complain and oppose housing, it's always an ignorance around who's living there. And if I can start sharing the stories of our community members who live in affordable housing, I think people will better understand and care about the development of that housing.
Mm-hmm. So your organization doesn't address the unhoused necessarily. It's more those working folks that can't afford to purchase or rent at a certain level. And they might even be living in their car.
Unfortunately, yes. Pikes Peak Housing Network is focused, I mean, we all are focused on the housing continuum, which does include homelessness and the unhoused. However, our work is much more focused on advocacy and education around affordable and attainable housing. However, that doesn't mean I don't talk and work with the nonprofits who are in that space, because again, it's a continuum. And we have to be working together, or we're not creating efficiencies and we're not supporting our community in the way that we need to. I mean, I can't be over here doing things that are completely in opposition to what they're doing. So we communicate and we try to work together to ensure all of our community is housed and safe.
So you mentioned trying to collaborate and bring folks together, developers, planners, etc. Are there other strategies that came out of your strategic planning process or that you're engaging in?
There's a lot that came out of that plan, and it's a little daunting for me as, again, a single person running an organization.
Yeah, our sustainability plan's kind of yeah, like that too.
I thought you might say that. So yes, there are a lot of things that came out of that plan. And I'll try to think of them off the top of my head. I should have written some of that down. So it's all education and advocacy. And so how do we best do that to encourage housing development? So this year we'll be hosting our first housing tour. And so that tour is for community leaders and elected leaders, and it's in September. It will go by four different housing projects. Two will be affordable housing projects. One is a middle-income housing project, but the first project in Colorado Springs to receive those middle tax credits. So you have folks who are in the 80 to 120% of area median income category that can live here, and now this property can get tax credits to support those individuals. And that is actually Darcy Niklasson's Mosaica. I don't know if you've heard of that project. I'll just give a shout out mm-hmm. to Darcy. And then we're going to go by Grecio Housing's new Bentley Commons project. They had 24 units and now they've added another 128, I believe. So those are all mm-hmm. affordable housing units. And then we're going to do a U-turn. I guess I should have started with the first project we're going to see is in downtown. That will be the Draper Commons. That's the first really affordable housing project in our downtown. Toby Gannett is doing that project, and that's open. So that's affordable, the Bentley Commons, Mosaica, and then we'll do a whole U-turn and go up north to Greenway Flats. No, it's not Greenway Flats. The flats at Greenway. It's classic homes, and it used to be a golf course on the east side of Powers, and they've converted it into housing. And so this is market rate, but it's all very innovative housing where they build the house with an optional accessory dwelling unit in it.
Okay.
And over 90% of the people who are having their homes built are adding that ADU, which I think is really compelling to our elected leaders who need to know that these types types of housing units are wanted by our community members, and we should be building more, and we should maybe be making it easier for them to build. And Classic's also building some really smaller zero lot line and denser housing units that I just think our community members should see. And then we'll come back. So that's one of the things we're doing, really hands-on, bringing people together. And so that will be invite only to community leaders and the electeds, so they can really get to know each other and understand. And we have a representative from CHAFA, the Colorado Housing and Finance Administration, there, who of course is making those awards for the tax credits, to really explain their process and how the elected leaders should understand that process to create capital A affordable housing. In addition, what are we doing? We are undertaking a media plan, whole media awareness education program, where we will be advertising, we will create advertisements and messaging around, it's just a pro-housing message. So we've raised a lot of money to hire a media consultant, and we're doing some polling. So we're about to undertake some polling that will query our community members on their support for affordable housing, housing in general, infill housing, and what percentage of our community is maybe not paying attention and are movable in that sphere. We know there's a lot of people who oppose housing, and we're not going to change their minds. We know there's plenty of people who support housing, but what is that missing piece of our community, and what messages would work for them? And then we're actually going to do some real advertising to try to change hearts and minds on the support for housing, which I think is important. In the data sphere, I mean, I mentioned we do quarterly reports. It's all in a dashboard on our website that show just the latest data on the price of housing, vacancy rates, rentals, what homes are being purchased for, permits for housing. And then I meet with all of our elected leaders often so that we can really help them. And I want to be there for them as projects come forward, housing projects, and they're concerned, hey, this doesn't fit in this neighborhood, this is going to create too much traffic. And I can help educate them and give them the data they need so that they feel comfortable supporting the project. And lastly, we are supporting individual developers as they bring housing projects forward through our planning process, our entitlement process. And if those projects are contentious in any way, we will work with them. I will attend their neighborhood meetings. I'll provide data for their neighborhood meetings. I've even led the neighborhood meeting like during the Q&A portion so that it doesn't become super contentious and mean. And then we'll help them prepare their presentations to the decision makers. And then I create talking points to support the projects. I have a housing champion list on that my newsletter and housing champions. So I'll send a call to action out to them, and they can write letters to the city council or come to city council to speak in support of the project. We only do that for contentious projects. It's always multifamily. It's always usually affordable or attainable housing. But those projects are the most important projects, and they're the hardest to get done because of all the misinformation the council members receive about how they will negatively impact neighborhoods.
I think your report said that 30 to 34% of some salaries go towards housing. So I'm kind of curious, what is the range that we're talking about for rents or home ownership?
Right.
I saw an article on a development in Boulder recently, and they were just finishing up an affordable housing project, and their rents were going to be in the neighborhood of $1,200, which also included utilities and Wi-Fi. So maybe you can kind of give us an idea of what we're talking about here.
Sure. So in El Paso County, we have an area median income for an individual and then a family of four. And so the area median income, so that 100% is around 80. I mean, you hear different things, but it's between $82,000 and $84,000. And so someone earning the area median income would qualify for what we would call attainable housing, because that's anywhere between 80% and 120% of area median income. And that means that that individual is not paying any more than 30% of their income on rent. for affordable housing, it varies on the property, but it is typically between 30 and 80% of the area median income. Someone earning in that salary range, 30% of that income can go to their rent and utilities. I can't do the math on that right now, but it is around that range. And we cannot build capital A affordable housing. That's what we call affordable housing that's within that range of 30 to 80% without subsidies, without tax credits or support from the federal government. It's really hard to build a door and charge a rent that is affordable without the subsidies. So we call that capital A affordable housing between 30 and 80. 80 to 120 and above. Above 120 is just market rate income, market rate housing. And those projects can be built without subsidies. And so the term affordable housing without the capital A is really what's affordable to you and, yeah, and you and me. Sure. Mm-hmm. And what's affordable to me is 30% of my whatever my income is. And in my May newsletter, I added a new dynamic to that. I put out a study of how we really shouldn't be spending more than 45% on our income between housing and transportation. And so transportation becomes a big piece of the conversation, because when a project comes forward, let's just say there was a recent project that was up north near Pine Creek neighborhood. It was across the street from two major employers, two hospitals, Children's Hospital and the UC Health Hospital. So major employers, especially with employees who earn a lower income between right. nurses and PAs and what have mm-hmm. you. Certainly you have the doctors. They're living in Pine Creek. So you have a project like that. And when it came forward, we were supporting the developer on that project. And so many of the neighbors in Pine Creek came and said, you know, we support affordable housing, just not here. Can we please, you know, just put it in the Southeast. It belongs in the Southeast. Just put it down there. And so, I mean, I think it's an important conversation to remind our leaders that there's plenty of affordable housing down in the Southeast, and it's very much needed. We also have a lot of folks who work up here who have to drive 20, 30 minutes to get home, adding to the cost of living and reducing their quality of life. And, of course, adding to congestion on our roads, pollution on our roads, and the cost to maintain our roads, all bad things. Mm-hmm. So it's really important for us to be thinking about caring for our citizens in a way that includes not just their cost of housing, but also transportation. And that, of course, promotes our mission to ensure that we're building affordable housing all over our city to accommodate all of our community who works all over our city or goes to school all over our city or sending their kids to school all over our city.
So many times the cost of housing is less the further out you go. And so that means some people are forced or need to live further out from where they work or from the center of our sure. communities. And transportation is a big part of that, with the vehicle, the insurance, the fuel, and all of that combined just adds to the cost of housing, of living.
Yes, know. It does.
Yeah. So I wanted to just mention the definition of sustainability that's in our
oh, good.
Looking to our future, Pikes Peak Region 2030. So it states, acting in a manner that improves our quality of life by balancing economic vitality, a healthy, vibrant community, and mindful stewardship of natural resources mm-hmm. and the environment for current and future generations. So basically nature, economy, society, and individual well-being.
Right.
And when you talk health and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to put that out there, because this affordable housing is very much a part of sustainability, and particularly with our built and natural environment goal, which talks about location efficiency that you were just mentioning, development, redevelopment, and so forth. And in addition to that, a separate goal on transportation.
Yes.
So right now, we're sort of the way we've been developing in the past. Uh-huh. And we kind of need to rethink
yes.
how we're looking at that to make transit, walkability, bikeability, all of that make sense mm-hmm. for where we live. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
May I
Please go.
So I was just reading an article about Euclidean development. I don't know if this term is familiar, but back in 1926, there was a Supreme Court ruling between somebody named Euclid and somebody else, I can't remember. And through that ruling, it gave cities the right to zone their communities in a way that separates commercial use from residential use. Mm-hmm. And it was meant in that time, as you can imagine, to separate dirty factories from residential. Mm-hmm. It's completely important work. But cities have taken that and just decided that they know how to best build a city. And I was thinking about that in how often the neighborhood that people bring up when we're having these conversations of opposition is the Old North End. The Old North End is a neighborhood filled with historic homes. They're beautiful. It is a wealthier community, and they want it to never change ever. And I get it. I probably wouldn't either. But it's interesting to me in that if that was passed in 1926, and that neighborhood was largely built in the last quarter century of the 1800s, they had 50 years in there before we started building in a Euclidean way. And my guess is that the Old North End back then was filled with boarding houses, people, you know, living amongst each other. A lot of those homes probably had a commercial use on the main floor, a cobbler or, you know, some sort of use. And there were likely corner markets all over. And of course, we know there were churches so that people could live and live their lives without cars. And that, of course, creates more community. It reduces all the time we spend in vehicles. It's sustainable. And it's a human-built type of neighborhood. And so I was thinking about that and how if the Old North End really wants to be historic, they should be going back to that type of use, which is
very interesting.
Which is interesting to me because I live in the Patty Jewett neighborhood adjacent to that, and our home prices are skyrocketing. And it's because our younger generation, the ones trying to buy homes now, they want that kind of lifestyle. They want to live in smaller homes, homes that are closer to the street so that they're closer to their neighbors, homes that I can walk to my store, the Safeway down the street, and they want that. They're coming back to wanting a simpler life. And we know our seniors want the same thing. They want to move out of their 4,000 square foot home into a smaller home where they can live closer to family or just more simply. So I think it's, you know, those are important messages. And my report talks about where our community is growing. And it really is the largest sectors are the demographics are 70 to 84 years old and the 18 to 24. We call them the bookends. We need to be thinking about how we're going to house these individuals and these families to ensure that they're safe and they can affordably live where they want. And I just think that whole Euclidean conversation is really relevant to today.
I think I read recently that We Fortify, which is another nonprofit, just is about ready or has opened up a second affordable housing for at-risk youth, tiny home community. I think John Olson, who was on a previous podcast of ours, you should check it out, talked about. And so I think that's an infill sort of development. And it was interesting when I read the article and I looked down to see if there were any comments. And I was surprised by the negativity of the comments of this home, how tiny they are, how close together they are, why are they just for the younger folks, that sort of thing. And really kind of surprised me because I'm such an advocate, I guess, is why that hit me like that.
First and foremost, don't read comments.
Yeah.
I learned that a long time ago.
I've heard of that. Yes, I've heard that.
So I actually serve with John Olson on the We Fortify board, and it is an interesting model. And so what you read in the paper is they got their second tiny home project approved through the city council. Okay. And so the first one is downtown, just south of Widener Field, where they play the soccer. And the second one is north of Fillmore, kind of round Prospect. So it's inside a neighborhood. And I bring it up because, I mean, it got approved at council a couple weeks ago, 9-0. And there were a couple people there who came to oppose the project vocally. They heard the presentation on the project, and one of them came up and said, I was going to come up here and oppose it, but now I support it.
Because
when they hear about the work that We Fortify is doing, it's really at-risk young adults. So you're an adult, you can only stay there a couple year, 2 years. And during that time, We Fortify is supporting these young people as they heal the trauma in their lives. They get a better education, they learn a trade, and then they get a job, a better job. And then, you know, we set them free. And so it is an amazing model. And giving these people, I mean, not an apartment, but some space of their own with no shared walls, as Shelley Jensen, the CEO, did a lot of work and to understand what these young people really need. And it's been an impressive project. So, and I'm really proud to call her friend and to be associated with that organization.
Great.
Sorry.
Well, also, you know, sustainability also includes the efficiency of the housing. Mm-hmm. So making sure they're efficient using energy and water. Mm-hmm. You probably don't get into that too much because it's really more of a developer thing, but it seems to me like that would be a great opportunity for developers to show what they can produce in that realm, because that's part of the cost of the rent. I mean, you know, you're paying for utilities on top of the rent, generally speaking, or it's included in the price of the rent.
Right. And when utilities go up, if your utilities are included, your rent's going up. So in that housing report I mentioned, we included a spreadsheet that shows how the housing costs have changed because of the rapid increases of utilities and insurance, homeowners insurance. So the ancillary costs to own a home or to rent are rising as utility costs and insurance costs rise. So it is a component, and we do discuss it. I mean, I'm not directly a part of that, but it's certainly something we discuss with developers. And, you know, what are we doing to keep utility costs low? And a lot of the developers are starting to do that. I mentioned Draper Commons, the affordable project in downtown. They have solar on their roof. They've also chosen to have every unit universally designed, which you don't have to, but that is really supportive of folks with disabilities and or even just a small disability. And to do that proactively, I've just been really impressed with that project. And that's only phase one of that project. They have two more phases. Sidebar. But no, you're not wrong. And we talk about the utility piece. And your developers are doing that proactively just as capitalists, because they know how important it is to keeping the cost of houses low. And I've been to a couple of the Parade of Homes, and they're including fast chargers in the garages and a lot of those smart kind of devices to keep your energy costs lower. So they're coming along.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Okay, this one's a little bit controversial, perhaps.
Time to go.
legislation was recently signed by the governor aimed at improving availability of affordable housing in our throughout the state. And then he signed also an executive order that requires local governments to show that they're enacting the recently passed housing laws in order to be eligible for more than $100 million in state grants for things like transportation and energy. Colorado Springs is one of the communities in opposition of the state regulating local government control of parking and density and other land use decisions. What are your thoughts about that, personally, or as a prior council person, or both, if they're different?
I don't think they are different, because I'm just who I am here. Yeah, that was a lot. So since I've been here, I've gone through two legislative sessions, and both legislative sessions in 24 and 25 were pretty difficult. And this legislature, I think most of them want to support affordable housing, and they are trying to react to that by passing bills that they think are going to support renters. Unfortunately, most of the bills that they pass end up increasing the rent for folks because they're passing along a lot of costs on landlords, and those costs will ultimately just get pushed down. That is kind of a sidebar. The bills you're talking about are all bills that the governor pushed through last year. One is this year. The one this year is the modernizing of stairs, of only allowing one set of stairs.
It included several different things.
Yeah. So there were a few from last year, and the issue with those bills is that all of them took away local control of the cities for land use and gave that land use control over to the state. And that goes against what's in our state constitution, that all land use is the control of the municipality or the county.
I think they call that home rule.
It's a home rule. Mm-hmm. And so the exception is when the state government says that something is of statewide concern and that they can usurp local control and push down a statewide rule. They did that when I was on council, when they pushed forward a law that said that homeowners associations couldn't require homeowners to have grass, turf, in their yards.
Okay.
And because so many homeowners associations were like, I need the green grass all through our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. People are like, no, we can't afford it. And I supported that because it was... I mean, these homeowners associations can be really bad and they very controlling, in my opinion. And so not allowing people to take their grass out and save water seemed, you know, completely ridiculous. So, yeah. So all these bills got passed, and then it was mostly for cities of over 100,000. So there's like not that many cities that are impacted, but it is most of the cities along the Front Range. And after this legislative session, the governor put out the EO, the executive order that you mentioned, that, yeah, says that those cities that don't comply, you don't comply, you're going to lose your funding for transportation and other things and housing. And you mentioned the city of Colorado Springs isn't supportive. I haven't heard that. There are six cities that have filed a lawsuit against the governor or the state saying, you know, you are in opposition to state law and the Constitution, and you can't force this down our throat. I had a conversation with the planning director the other day, and I said, what do you think about this? And he said, we're largely in compliance. And we largely are. We did pass an accessory dwelling unit ordinance last month or a couple months ago. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
It was a big update to the one that was passed when I was on council, and it almost is in line with what the state law requested, except that we don't allow detached accessory dwelling units in what we call the WUI, the wildland urban interface. And I don't support that. I think we need to allow everybody to build an ADU if they want one. But it's moving in the right direction. And we have also done parking minimums. The city has largely complied. So it makes sense that we don't engage on the lawsuit. The bill I mentioned, or the new law I mentioned about the stairs, what that does is currently there's a requirement that if you have an apartment building five stories or under, you have to have two sets of stairs for egress. The new law says that you only have to have one set of stairs. And the city of Colorado Springs did oppose that bill. I supported it. We didn't come out and talk about it at Pikes Peak Housing Network, but it costs developers a lot more to build affordable housing when they have to build two sets of stairs. And it takes up a lot more land, too. So the city will have another year to comply with that law. But, I mean, I don't support the governor, you know, putting his thumb down on the communities. I would support a more incentive-based type of reaction where, you know, you might get more money if you comply, or we will have different types of support financially if you comply. When the accessory dwelling unit bill was passed, there was a conversation about how if you pass this bill, we will provide incentives to lower income community members to build accessory dwelling units. Now, that's a great incentive because it's expensive to build an accessory dwelling unit. So I think Colorado Springs is moving in the right direction. And
yeah. Well, I think that the home rule question, I can see, you know, if you're home rule, you don't want to be told. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to make your own land use decisions. And that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to agree with what you're saying there. All right. Well, I think we're about ready to wrap this up, but I want to ask, how can citizens support what you're doing, and how can we help advocate for affordable, accessible, attainable housing?
That's a great question, Mary. Thank you. As an advocacy organization, the more voices we have supporting these issues is a force multiplier for me. So if you're interested in engaging, you can go to our website and start receiving our newsletter, or let me know you want to be a housing supporter, and I'll put you on a separate list, and you'll receive more information about individual housing projects or policies that are coming forward. I'll send talking points out to you, and you can engage by reaching out to your legislators or your council members and let them know you support this housing. And that is the biggest and most important thing that our community members can do, because they need to know that it's not just me up there and it's not just a few crazy greenies. It is, you know, the majority of our community cares about our young people. My son and daughter are trying to live here, and I think a lot of other people's kids would love to live here but can't afford to. So we need to get that word out and have our community support housing, and together we can affect some great change in our community that's also sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and announcements of late that have said new businesses are moving into our community, which just makes us need more housing and probably more affordable housing, depending on what kind of operation it is, because they might be in the lower salary levels than we might like.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. Dave, do you have any questions?
Are developers and home builders kind of split in terms of support versus opposition to what you're doing, or are they all for what you're doing?
Yeah, they are universally supportive, and they're financially supportive of the media campaign that I mentioned. In fact, that media campaign was kind of bubbling up before I came on board between the city of Colorado Springs, the chamber, and our Home Builders Association, because they just couldn't figure out how can we get the message out that housing is important. That there are a couple of well-funded, very organized housing opposition groups in our community. And they are, I said, well-funded, and they're getting their message out, that, and they send out messages that are inaccurate about the negative impacts of housing, and we're just not responding. So it's important for us to kind of get on the offensive and start letting people know that, you know, putting a 100-unit property on this corner is not going to, you know, add 20 minutes to your commute every day. It's just not going to do anything harmful to you except help support your community members. So,
are city policies and practices obstacles in some ways, or are those really not things that you have to work on?
Yeah, that is largely what I work on. I mean, we have the individual projects, but then modifying regulations and that whole regulatory environment to make it easier to build smaller homes, duplexes, those types of properties are a huge part of our work. Right now, we're about to have a walking tour through the Hillside neighborhood. If you know this neighborhood, it's just
southeast, right?
Well, it's right by Memorial Park. We're going to walk by a few of the properties that have done some triplexes and some cool things, and then some vacant land to see what potentials are. And then there's a church there that has a lot of land. And if you know, there was our community has been really focusing on the idea of YGBI, Yes in God's Backyard. As church membership declines, churches and all religious institutions are struggling financially, and so trying to find uses for their land. They often have prime real estate, and it serves part of their mission to potentially build affordable housing and then support that community. We have one project already opened up in the southeast, and then there's another one being built in the northeast. Grecio Housing is a part of that with Woodman Valley Chapel. And so making it easier for those types of projects to be built, making the zoning easier for them is something we're working on. But we're inviting all sorts of fun people to the Hillside neighborhood so they can see. Our goal there is to potentially get the city to do a pilot project where they upzone that area and allow denser, just a, you know, like 5 blocks. Can we just do more here and see how it goes? So pilot projects, but there are a lot of regulations that we could be changing. The ADUs was one of them, and Pikes Peak Housing Network really led that and got that pushed forward, and then they took it and ran with it. So it was a good local policy for us to work on. Pikes Peak Housing Network also has a policy committee. It's called the Housing Policy Advisory Committee, and a lot of great people are on that, to include like Amy Cox from the city. She is also on my board. our planning director, people from the Home Builders Association, and a lot of people in between. And they guide my policy direction and work and bring things to me. Here's, you know, we could be working on this. Here's how we could do this. And so it's not just me in a vacuum or my own little echo chamber making decisions about what I do. And it's great to have their input and feedback.
It seems like there could be more investment maybe in transit mm-hmm. and Mountain Metro and the transportation side mm-hmm. and less on some other aspects like people moving out east.
Well, it's hard to provide a robust transit system to such a huge geographic city. Mm-hmm. And so if we can densify certain areas and mm-hmm. it makes it more conducive to transit. And so that is one of the goals.
All right. Let's thank Jill Gabler, Executive Director of the Pikes Peak Housing Network, for sharing their vision and approach for affordable and attainable housing in the Pikes Peak region. A recording of the SIP will be available on Studio 809's Peak Environment Podcast website in 1 to 2 weeks. You can sign up for Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Futures monthly newsletter to receive information about the SIP and other community events. Follow the Sustainable and Resilient Pikes Peak Region Facebook group to stay informed about the region's sustainability progress and share your efforts and opportunities. If there are friends or colleagues you wish were here for today's presentation, don't forget this will be available within a week or two as the next episode of the Peak Environment Podcast. So recommend that to your friends. And we thank Studio 809 Podcast for making this happen. Special thanks to Pikes Peak Permaculture for supporting Peak Environment. You can visit pikespeakpermaculture.org for opportunities to learn about sustainable organic living through permaculture, including workshops, classes, field trips, and networking. I have a couple of announcements that I'd like to go ahead and make. Air Quality Awareness Week was May 5th through the 9th, and there is an episode on Peak Environment called Examining Air Quality in Colorado's Pike Peak Region. I'd encourage you to listen to that podcast. And I heard recently that Mountain Metro has free summer rides back in 2025, June 1st through August 31st. So you can visit the Mountain Metro website and get more information on that. Mark your calendars for the next SIP, or Sustainability in Progress, which will be on June 18th. And I've got that already set up. We're going to hear from PPACG about the 2050 Long Range Transportation Plan and Mountain Metro News. So thank you for joining us for this month's Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Futures Sustainability in Progress speaker series. The discussion's been great, and so let's keep it going. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Peak Environment. This episode was courtesy of Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future. For more information, visit peakalliance.org.
In the Pikes Peak region, there's no shortage of activities. Whether you're experiencing breathtaking parks or magnificent works of art, if you're getting fashionable at a film festival, or fresh at a farmer's market, if you want to hear the sweet sounds of a symphony or the smooth shred of a Stratocaster, look no further than Peak Radar, your one-stop shop for all events in the Pikes Peak region, your free source for viewing and posting events. So no matter how you engage with our beautiful region, visit peakradar.com and get plugged into the peak.